You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is Sunday, February 25th, 2018. I just want to get right to our interview today with Jeanette Dorner from the Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group. We have a lot to talk about, and so let's get right to it. We are back here on the Whale Scout Podcast with Jeanette Dorner. She is the director of the Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group. Jeanette, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Whitney. Thanks for having me back on.
Of course. Thank you for being with us. I was listening back a little bit to our conversation back in December, and you know, we talked about the Atlantic salmon issue just sort of heating up, and now there's a lot going on in Olympia. I want to start just right off the bat, diving right into everything that's happening right now with the Atlantic salmon fish farms in Washington. Can you give us an update on what's going on in Olympia?
Sure. Well, so, you know, I think that there's, as you said, there's been a lot of activity. I think the spill that happened last year really heightened people's awareness, even though these net pens have been operating for a while now in Puget Sound. More people are aware that we've had this non-native fish being raised in these net pens and some of the dangers around doing that. And so our elected officials have also heightened awareness as well. And so there's been some bills going through the legislature, and also our state agencies and the governor's office have really been taking a hard look at what's going on with the net pens. And so the legislation that's going through in Olympia right now would ban net pens, phase them out, I think by 2020, and not allow having net pens for non-native salmon species in Puget Sound in Washington State anymore. And then the Department of Natural Resources has been doing a lot of work to look at what's going on with the net pens, and recently released a big report on just how poorly these net pens were being maintained, and investigated other net pens in addition to the one that collapsed, and found that others have some very serious maintenance issues as well. So a lot of attention, and I think it's looking like we are moving towards a decision where in the future we won't have these net pens anymore in Washington State for Atlantic salmon.
So it sounds like you are optimistic that these will be removed from Puget Sound.
It seems like that. The momentum is definitely in that direction. Our Public Lands Commissioner, Hillary Franz, has been pretty pretty committed to making sure that this is taken care of and that they are held accountable. And the legislature also seems to be pretty supportive as well of these bills that are going through right now. So I think people just really realize that it's the any kind of benefit from jobs or that kind of thing, the small benefit, it really is outweighed by the risks that having these facilities in our marine waters off in Washington is just too much of a risk for our native salmon. We're investing so much in trying to protect and restore these species that are important to our communities, and it's not worth the risk to have these non-native fish, especially these net pens have been so poorly maintained. So I don't think that we're going to have them much longer. I know that the company that operates them is pushing back, obviously. They don't want to get shut down, but I think it's too little too late.
And there's also been news recently about these escaped Atlantic salmon having piscine reel virus. Can you tell us a little bit about this virus and what that means for wild fish?
Yeah, and so the Wild Fish Conservancy released a report saying they did an analysis and they found that all the fish had this disease. This is a disease that can spread to our native salmon as well, so that is a concern. I will say, though, that, and I haven't talked to all the experts on this one, but I did see that there are some scientists at the Department of Fish and Wildlife that disagree with the findings of Wild Fish Conservancy, so it's tough to know for certain at this point whose information is the most accurate, but certainly the spread of diseases from these non-native fish that are held in these really tight spaces where it fosters these kinds of diseases has been a significant concern. So even if not all of them had it, even if some of them had it, it's a risk that we really don't need to have. There's not enough benefit to make it worth that risk.
And, you know, you've been mentioning these net pens and having non-native salmon in these net pens. Are there, and can you describe any native salmon or other fish net pens in Puget Sound?
Yeah, there are. As part of the hatchery program and the co-manager work, there are some places in Puget Sound that have net pens for native salmon. And they're run by the tribes. I'm trying to remember if there's any that are run actually by Fish and Wildlife. There's a couple around. But they are managing them to support harvest objectives. And they also, they have an interest in managing them in a way that protects the wild runs as well. And so there's not as much concern from those net pens as there is from the impact of the non-native salmon.
And going back to this piscine reel virus, so what happens to wild fish if they were to contract this virus?
You know, actually, I don't have the expertise on the specifics of how the disease affects them. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that question accurately.
Okay.
I just know it's not good for them. They have so many... there are so many things that they're already struggling to survive that having this disease attack them as well is just one more thing that if we can prevent that, it's one more thing that we don't need to
sure
incur that risk.
Of course. And another interesting issue that I've been hearing rumors about in Olympia, both in the governor's office and in a bill that was introduced by Senator Ranker about increasing hatchery production of Chinook salmon. What are your thoughts on that? You know, this is being introduced in order to help feed orcas. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so there's also been some heightened attention, I think, from our elected officials about the plight of the orcas and the low numbers for the southern resident population. And so that has led to some new initiatives and some creative thinking, kind of thinking out of the box. And that's what we're seeing in some of the legislation. And they're recognizing, as those that care deeply about orcas and orca recovery know, the three main things that are affecting the orcas are the lack of prey, food, the salmon, the toxics, and then also impacts from vessel noise. And so these bills that are going through the legislature right now and the governor's proposal is looking at how to address those things. And particularly the one that you're mentioning is trying to address that first factor of loss of available prey, not having enough salmon for the whales to eat. And so, you know, I think that it may pass. I think it may end up in the budget. They're talking about the budget right now, and I know the governor has proposed in his budget, in supplemental budget, to increase hatchery production to support the orcas. I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that it needs to be done thoughtfully, because hatchery programs can be a benefit or they can be a problem depending on how they're managed. And so it's not a simple solution where you can just suddenly increase hatchery numbers everywhere and there'll be more fish for the orcas to eat, and there will be no negative impacts. So I know that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is working pretty closely with the elected officials to try and help guide them on a proposal that would make sense, because you don't want to have an increase in hatchery fish in a way that would cause too much competition with the wild fish that we're trying to recover. So that's where some thoughtful conversations need to happen. But I think that one of the things that's interesting in this discussion is that, well, I think it's great that people are thinking out of the box and looking for some short-term solutions. There still isn't as much conversation as I'd like to see on the long-term solution to lack of prey, and the fact that we have been working for quite a few years on this problem of not enough salmon, and there has not been the level of resources or commitment needed to really turn the dial back in the direction that we've been trying to turn it, even though salmon have been listed under the Endangered Species Act since 1999 in Washington State. And so I hope that in addition to these out-of-the-box initiatives, that decision makers will also take another look at adding additional resources to help us implement the salmon recovery plans that are already in existence. Because we do have plans that were completed, that there are many people who are trying to implement them, and we are not making the progress that we want to make for two reasons. One, the level of resources that have been committed to implementing those plans is only at a maximum 20% of what was actually needed. So we're moving much more slowly than what was originally anticipated. And number two, we still have a number of policies and regulations that are not protective of the habitats that would ensure that salmon can be productive and thrive. And so we still see habitat continue to be damaged and not enough resources also being allocated to projects that would help restore that habitat. So we really need to be looking long-term also at how do we dedicate the right available resources and policies in order to make a real difference long-term for salmon populations.
Is there any way to sort of add an amendment to this legislation that would mandate funding for habitat or help correct some of these policies that you're saying are leading to habitat destruction?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's been sort of different attempts at that, and they have just not gone very well. The political will isn't there. So I wouldn't say this legislative session is a short session. They're getting towards the end. I don't think that there is, well, for one, we've already passed the point when new bills could be even offered. So we've passed that cutoff point. And number two, there are just certain final negotiations about the budget right now in the next couple weeks. So I think it's really about, you know, going forward with the initiatives that they've talked about this session. But right now is the time, as soon as this session completes, is the time to start talking about what's our budget going to look like in the next biennium. And they start having those discussions in the legislature in their next session, which starts in January of 2019. But the preparation for that session starts now, like in the late spring and summer, and then working with the agencies, and then the agencies propose their budgets in September to the governor's office, and then the governor releases his proposed budget for the next biennium in December. And so right now is the time to start saying, how do we turn the dials so that we're actually allocating the resources that the salmon recovery plans said was needed to get the job done? And that, I think, is going to take some time to have that conversation and get decision makers to a point where they can identify where those additional resources are going to come from.
And how would you suggest that individuals who are listening get involved in that process?
I think that they can be letting their elected officials know that this is important to them, that they want to see long-term salmon recovery you know, thank them for thinking out of the box and short-term solutions, but that they also want to see a renewed and increased dedication to long-term solutions. And that, you know, when legislators are in their legislative session, they're very busy. And if you go down to Olympia to go talk to them, which can make an impact, but they're very busy, so you get maybe, if you're lucky, about 15 minutes to sit down and talk with them, and then they've got to move on to their next thing. When they're done with the session, when they're home, then you can actually make an appointment to go see them, and usually you can spend more time with them, or they have more time to take a phone call or to read your letters. And so the off session is actually a really good time to reach out to legislators in advance of the next session, so they have time to understand what's important to their constituents and be thinking about it and preparing for that session, rather than being in the heat of the session where everything is so fast-paced and it's hard to keep up.
That's a great
point.
So
I would suggest that if people care about that, they'd let their legislators know in the off session, or, you know, between now and January, salmon recovery is important to us. We want to see increased funding for grants and programs that support salmon recovery and implement the salmon recovery plans. And we want to see policies that protect habitat for these salmon. I think just keeping it that simple, and the legislators can know which of those programs, or they can talk to the folks that have the expertise in salmon recovery about which of those programs are the ones that will make the biggest difference in implementing what's in the salmon recovery plans.
And, you know, it always makes me wonder, when we talk about increasing hatchery production, do you think that fishermen are going to, you know, their ears are going to perk up and be interested in increasing their fishing as well?
Oh, certainly. I mean, you know, much of the fishing that's happening right now is due to hatchery programs. That's the primary source of salmon that people can fish on, because so many of our wild stocks are depressed or listed. And so when you increase hatchery production for orcas, there's certainly going to be more hatchery fish out there for fishermen as well. And it's not like the fish are going to be marked for orcas or for fishermen. You know, you just know that it's a hatchery fish, right? So there'll be more for both of them. So I'm sure that they, you know, anything that increases their opportunity to go fishing, I think is something that fishermen usually support.
And can you tell us a little bit more about some of the other projects that Mid-Sound Fisheries Enhancement Group is working on? I understand you just recently did a restoration project along the Green River.
Yeah, so we have been partnering with an organization called the Green River Coalition, who has an agreement with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, actually. There's a property that Fish and Wildlife has on the Green River in Auburn that is an access point for fishermen and for boaters. And there was a need to restore the plant community along the bank there. The site had been overgrown with invasive plants and blackberries. And so the coalition took that on a couple years ago. And more recently, we partnered with them to build on those efforts. And so we've been working together to continue to take out the invasives and to plant native trees and shrubs that can grow into restored native plant community along the bank there. And one of the things that's really important for the Green River, that's a very high priority in the salmon recovery plan for that system, is to get more tall trees along the banks of the river and some of the critical salmon streams to create shade, because water temperature in the river and in some of these critical salmon streams is too high at times for the health of the salmon, and it can either make them sick or kill them depending on how high the water temperature gets. And so a long-term solution to that is restoring the canopy that was there historically and putting tall trees back along the riverbanks. And so this project is part of that larger effort that's happening all up and down the system. They actually have a name for that strategy. It's called Green the Green. So so this project is one of many that partners are working on to green the green and try and get shade back on the river and help keep the water cool for the fish.
That's great. Are there any other upcoming projects that people could get involved with on the Green River or elsewhere?
Yeah, so we'll probably have more events at this particular site. I mean, the thing about restoration sites is, you know, people might show up for one event and then think they're done, but really, you know, it's a couple years at minimum. You need to really be invested in the site and take care of it to make sure that the invasives don't come back and that the plants that you planted survive until they can get established. So we'll have other opportunities to go back out to that site. And then we are also working in the Sioux Creek Basin, which is one of the two most important tributaries to the Green Duwamish system. There's the Sioux Creek and Newaukum Creek, and those two are the most important tributaries for salmon habitat. And so Sioux Creek runs sort of in the Kent-Covington-Maple Valley area and then down into the Green River. And so we are, again, working with the Green River Coalition and students at Green River College to reach out to folks in that basin and look for opportunities to do restoration projects to restore that tree canopy and restore the habitat in the stream. And coming up soon, I've been working with the city of Covington. The grant funding that we had to do the project that we were just talking about down on the Green River, there's also some funding to work with them on doing some plantings in one of their parks called Jenkins Creek Park. But they were just completing a master plan for that park. So we've been waiting for them to complete the master plan to make sure that the planting that we do is consistent with their new master plan. So in the next month or two, they're finishing up their plan this month. And so in the next month or two, we're hoping that we'll be able to schedule a planting event out there on Jenkins Creek, which is part of the Sioux Creek system.
Great. Yeah, we look forward to hearing about that and possibly sending some volunteers your way. We'll certainly do our best. And we love getting out and getting dirty to help salmon.
That's great. You know, Whitney, before I forget, there is we've been talking a lot about what we've been doing in the Green Duwamish system, but we also work in the Cedar Sammamish system. And one of the sites that we are actively working on in partnership with King County Parks is right on the Sammamish River as well. And it's next to what was formerly the Red Hook Brewery. And there's a stretch of riverbank there that is owned by King County Parks right next to where the brewery was. And it's just totally overgrown with blackberries. So we've had a couple different work parties to go in and pull blackberries. And then our group has a grant through King County that council member Claudia Balducci was able to help us get through their waterworks program to put together a planting plan so that we can replant trees along the banks there on the Sammamish River. So we'll be looking for folks to help us go out and help pull some more blackberries. And then once we get the planting plan done, we'll be organizing some planting projects to get the trees in there as well.
Well, that sounds great. That's right up in my neck of the woods, like you said, on the Sammamish River. And I wanted to mention, we talked a little bit about this before we started talking today on the podcast, about a project that that I've been working on locally in Bothell. The city of Bothell has purchased the former Wayne Golf Course, and it is now a public park. And moving forward in the process, the city is looking to name the park. And so I did a lot of research and was really interested in, of course, the salmon, but the community of Bothell was also really interested in the Native American perspective and, you know, the people that lived along the Sammamish River before Bothell was here as we know it. So I did a lot of research in reading interviews from Native Americans. And one thing that really struck me was that people were discussing redfish and talking about how they love to fish for them, eat them. And it was a significant played a significant role in their lives in bringing them to the Sammamish River. And the more I read, I realized these were kokanee, actually, not, you know, Chinook salmon or coho, but small kokanee that are, as I've learned, the sort of cousins of sockeye that are a landlocked version. And so my idea would be to name the park Redfish Park in honor of the natural resources that brought people to the area. So I've been working with a researcher, Dr. Jeff Jensen at UW-Bothell, and of course, David Bain, who's been really active in this whole project. So, you know, and we're hoping that the name will draw attention to salmon and, of course, kokanee, and will invite people to explore this larger story of the people and the place. And as I understand it, there's a lot of work being done in Lake Sammamish around kokanee, and that your group has been involved on Ebright Creek, which is one of the places where kokanee spawn. Can you tell us about kokanee and your work on Ebright Creek?
Sure. Yeah. So it's great that you did that research, and I love that name. So yeah, one of the things that's been fascinating to me after taking this job with Miss Sound is when you get to dive in deeper in a particular watershed and learn more about its history and the history of the people is and the history of the fish and the history of the ecology of the watershed. And the thing that to remember, especially about the Cedar, Lake Washington, Sammamish system, is how dramatically it's been altered from historic times. And so if you think about, I mean, just the direction of the water and how water flowed out of that system historically is completely different than now, because it historically went through the south end of Lake Washington and through the Black River, which doesn't even hardly really exist anymore, and then it would connect and it went out the Green Duwamish. Well, when we built the Corps built the Ballard Locks and did the Montlake Cut, then there was a different outlet for the system than there had been historically. And so one of the things to realize is that the reason that, as you discovered, the kokanee was actually the dominant salmon in the Lake Washington Sammamish system is because it actually wasn't as well connected with the saltwater as other river systems. If you imagine at the south end of Lake Washington, where it was leaving and going into the Black River, it was a sort of a complex of wetlands. It wasn't like one straight channel that went out and connected with the Green. And the same thing with the whole Sammamish River. It was a large wetland complex. It wasn't the wide open, defined river channel that it is now after the Corps of Engineers did its flood project.
Right. I learned that it went from 30 miles to 10 miles.
Yeah. It's pretty dramatic how different the system is now. And so kokanee, as you said, they are the non-anadromous, so they don't go out into saltwater, version of sockeye salmon. And so they are the same genetically as sockeye, but they only live in the freshwater. And so they spawn in the streams, just like our other types of salmon do. And then they need a lake. And so they go out into the lake and they live their adult life in the lake, sort of like the other types of salmon go out into the ocean. And then when they're done with their adult lives, then they return to their streams to spawn again. And so there were two main kokanee populations in the Lake Washington Sammamish system. One, the North Lake Washington kokanee population, which is the one that the professor you mentioned at UW-Bothell is working on, and that was in that section of the Sammamish where the Wayne Golf Course Park is now. And then there's the Lake Sammamish kokanee population. And I believe that there are no known remnants of the North Lake Washington population anymore. I know that the professor has been looking to see if they can find anything or figure out a way to reintroduce. But in the Sammamish system, there still is a Lake Sammamish kokanee population. And there is a work group that is made up of a number of different jurisdictions and organizations that are dedicated to the recovery of the Lake Sammamish Kokanee. And they've been working together very closely for a while now on trying to take care of the little redfish in the Sammamish system and keep them from blinking out. And so we at MidSound are one of those partners. And as you mentioned, we did have a project that we worked with others on that was on Ebright Creek, which is a small stream that runs into Lake Sammamish towards the little bit towards the southern end. And it was a partnership with, the landowner. There's a wonderful landowner who is very active in the Kokanee work group as well, who made his property available for the restoration. And then we partnered with the Snoqualmie Tribe, which has a great restoration crew and a lot of expertise, and then also Trout Unlimited, which is a huge supporter of the Kokanee work group and actually has a full-time staff member that his full-time job is to work on the Kokanee recovery effort. And so we all partnered together and removed a bunch of invasive blackberries, sounds familiar, along Ebright Creek. And then we went in the fall, and we had a series of two different planting events where we had volunteers that came out and helped us plant a bunch of native trees and shrubs all along the banks where the blackberries had been removed, and then put a bunch of wood chip mulch in to try and take care of them so that they've get a chance to get established and grow. So that was a fun project, and we had a great turnout and lots of folks. And so now we're working with the partners to look at where our next project will be and working on some grants for one of the other creeks. There's a couple different creeks in more towards the south end of Lake Sammamish that support the Kokanee. And so we're working to keep that that effort going as well with all the great partners. One of the things that I will mention, though, for folks that have been following it closely, the Kokanee Work Group is especially concerned right now. We're concerned that we might be at a tipping point. The returns this last fall and the one previously were some of the lowest on record, like to the tune of, I think it was about 22 fish that showed up this fall. It was pretty bad. And so the last meeting of the Kokanee Work Group, which is organized by King County, actually, their staff is the lead for bringing everybody together. We had some talks about emergency measures, potential emergency measures, if this fall, if we get another bad run, because they have a 3-year cycle, 3 to 4 year cycle of their lives, and so, you know, all salmon populations can be a bit cyclic, so you can see some, you know, low years and then higher years. But to have two really bad years in a row, if we have another bad year this year, then it's a serious problem. Right. And so people are trying to do some advanced planning to think of things that we could do to try and not let this population blink out completely.
Wow, and to think that they were so culturally important for the tribes and the history of this area, it would really be a shame if something like that were to happen. And it's interesting to note, too, that you mentioned the blackberries and planting. Some of the same solutions for our other salmon species are the same solutions for these kokanee.
Exactly. You know, I mean, we know what kind of habitat is good for the fish, and so trying to restore that wherever we can, where we know that they are, that's one of the most valuable things that we can do. Now, there is the scientists are trying to do some research also about what's going on in the lake environment to try and understand if there's something going on when they're living in the lake that's causing them to crash in this way as well. So there's more for us to learn. But we definitely know in the freshwater habitats what are the things that we need to do in order to make good habitat for them if when they return. So we'll have to keep working at that.
Yeah.
Certainly the Snoqualmie tribe is a really important partner in those efforts in the Lake Sammamish Kokanee. They've done a lot to support that effort.
Yeah, a full-time staff member. I mean, that is a commitment for sure.
Oh, well, that's the Trout Unlimited.
Oh, Trout Unlimited. I'm sorry.
Yeah, has a full-time staff member. But the Snoqualmie tribe has a full restoration program and crew, and they work on Kokanee projects as well as other salmon projects in the traditional areas of the Snoqualmie tribe. And so they're doing a lot of really good work, both in that system and then over on the Snoqualmie River system as well.
And I have to ask, what sort of emergency measures could take place?
Well, there's a whole range that they're thinking about right now, from like an emergency sort of capture and hatchery program. That's one of them. Now I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what some of the others were. But, you know, at some point, you know, you want to try and see if you can protect the genetics, because once they disappear completely, you've lost those genetics and you can never get them back again.
Right.
So that's the kind of conversation that they're having.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
So anything that us individuals can do to help out Sammamish River and Lake Sammamish Kokanee?
Well, you know, I think certainly when we have volunteer events, we'll post them and let folks know when they can come out to help us with restoring habitat. We're doing something kind of fun as an outreach activity coming up next month, where we're just trying to, you know, part of it is just raising awareness, because a lot of people who live in this community might have no idea about this fish and its importance to the history of the area, and so just educating people about the fact that these fish exist and that they need our help is really valuable. And so one of the outreach things that a couple of the partners that we're doing together is, there is an event coming up in Lake Sammamish State Park that's organized by the East Indian community, and it's a celebration of the Hindu festival called Holi. And this is a big, big festival in India where it's sort of a celebration of spring and colors, and it's a celebration of community and family, and it's just a really fun kind of event where they have all these different colored powders, and people run around and throw colored powders on each other.
Okay.
And, you know, we have all sorts of really odd holidays, right? So they have, you know, this is a fun tradition. And so everybody's just like covered in all these different colors. And so it's actually really beautiful.
Yeah.
And people just have a really good time. And it typically happens sometime around March. And so this year they're having it, what they do for the East Indian community that lives in that area, they rent out part of the Lake Sammamish State Park to have this festival for an afternoon. And so we are partnering with them to educate folks while they're there about the salmon that are in Lake Sammamish. And so we are having a salmon painting activity. So we're going to bring some sort of rubber silicone salmon, and we're going to have a bunch of different colored paints. And this is actually a Japanese art form where you actually paint the fish, and then you take a piece of paper or a piece of cloth, and you can press it against the fish and then slowly peel it up, and then you have a salmon print.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought it'd be a fun way of connecting the celebration of colors with the fish. And so, we didn't want to make it too heavy, because this festival is just about, you know, people getting together and having a good time. But it's a way to sort of let people know there are salmon in this area, and they need our help, and then have some information there if they want to get involved in the future, how they could get involved in helping out with volunteer events and that kind of thing.
Well, you got to celebrate the fish too, right?
Exactly.
Cool. Well, that sounds like a really fun project. I'll be sure to post a link about that and some of the other things we've been talking about today. Is there anything else that you want to share with the folks in the whale world about salmon today?
You know, I think the thing to just keep in mind is that, you know, I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of folks now that care deeply about the whales. And there's something about the whales that just really touches people and inspires them, and that is so wonderful. And I think the more that we can partner together to channel that that love and that commitment and that energy into actions that make a real difference for the whales, I think is so valuable. Because, you know, not everybody necessarily gets excited about salmon. They don't inspire the kind of excitement necessarily for all people like the orcas do. But we won't have the southern resident orcas anymore if we don't have salmon. And so the more that people who care about orcas can partner with people who are working on salmon, I think we can actually help each other. And so I really encourage people to, you know, get on our website or sign up for our email list. And, you know, we're not the only organization working on salmon. There are we're blessed that we actually have a number of organizations in the central Puget Sound area that are working on salmon. So there's lots of opportunities for people to get engaged. In fact, actually, Whitney, one of your Whale Scout volunteers was at our event last Saturday.
Awesome.
And she was saying how she was newer to the area and she was looking for ways to get out on the weekends and do something to make a difference for the fish and the orcas. And so that was wonderful to have her out there, and she did a lot of great work helping us take care of the plant. So,
yay, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point of what we're trying to do, is channel that interest into these projects, you know, channel whales into mulch and trees and annihilating blackberries. And so I'm glad to hear that. I do have to disagree with you on one thing, though. I think salmon are very exciting, and I think they are inspiring. You know, I've, of course, been a dork orca for a long time, but I'm totally turning into a fish freak here. And the more I learn about the salmon, I just keep going with it. I took a long class this fall, and after that came out with even more questions than I had going in. And you know, buying books and going out. I took my daughter all out to Kitsap so we could go see chum spawnings. We've got sockeye here that we see. I know we have other species that are just a little bit trickier for us to see, but, you know, we're getting fully obsessed. So I think it can go both ways.
I stand corrected. So definitely it is possible to get super excited about salmon, and they are fascinating creatures, and their role in the ecosystem,
yes,
and how they affect our whole community, I think, is fascinating. But not everybody falls into that as easily as the orcas. And so I think what we have to do is use that as a jumping off platform,
sure,
so that more people can get excited about the fish in the way that you just described. Because I think that when you start diving into that, especially the research that you're doing on the history, it's when you start taking the long view of this place that we live, this landscape that we're in, and the history and the role of salmon in that history, both in the past and the potential role of salmon in the future.
Yeah.
You start realizing how salmon are, I like to call them the great connector. They really sort of sew everything together. Because they go out to the ocean and then they come back into the freshwater, and they bring the cycle backwards. Because when you think about the cycle, you think about things flowing down,
right,
through the streams
ocean
and out into the ocean. And the salmon actually bring things back up from the ocean, back up into the freshwater streams and the headwaters.
Yeah.
And so they are a critical part of that cycle. Without them, that cycle would disappear. And so, and they're so important to us culturally. They're important as a food, as a source of local healthy food. They're important to the First Peoples who lived here for thousands upon thousands of years before many of the rest of us got here. And they are essential to their traditions and their culture and their way of life and being able to continue that. And so there's just so many reasons why I feel so passionate about the importance of salmon in our community and why we need to take care of them, because I think, you know, the future of our community is really at stake. But folks that have just come to this area maybe and haven't understood that yet, we have an opportunity to educate people as they come here, to take them out to the rivers when the salmon are spawning, to the streams, and see them, and tell that story, and explain why it's important for us to take care of them. And when we take care of them, we're taking care of ourselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm totally with you. Salmon
yeah.
are cool.
Yeah, they're super cool. There's, I mean, nothing like being at home in Bothell, seemingly so far away from the ocean, and watching salmon come back, like little messengers from the ocean. It's really cool. It makes you feel really connected, and yeah. Anyway, I could go on forever, but I won't. I want to thank you so much for coming on the Whale Scout podcast today, and we will talk to you very soon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
Thank you all so much for listening today. I want to leave you with a few opportunities for you to get involved. Our next Helping Out event will be at the Maury Island Marine Park, and that's on March 24th, and this will be our third trip out to the Marine Park, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. It's a wonderful way to spend a day taking the ferry out to Vashon Maury Island, and we'll be finishing up the last of the planting season, doing a little bit more planting trees. This is on a former mine site, a gravel and sand and gravel mine, and so the site could really use some help with some more trees put back into place to help with the erosion, and that will help with the nearshore habitat, home to juvenile salmon and forage fish, which feed other salmon, and so it's a really important place to come and help, and it's always a favorite of ours. So check out the website. You do need to RSVP. So go to whalescout.org to RSVP and look at all the other details that you need to know in order to come. And as I mentioned with Jeanette, I am working on this project to name Bothell's newest park, Redfish Park. And so if you go up and visit whalescout.org, you can read my explanation to the city of why Redfish Park is the best name, and learn more about Kokanee and about the Native Americans and why this is all so important for the city of Bothell and by extension the salmon and our killer whales. There will be opportunities, if you are able to get this before February 28th, to submit Redfish Park as a name that you would like, or any other name, to the city of Bothell. And on March 8th, the Bothell Parks and Rec Board will be discussing names, and that will be an extremely important meeting. If you want to come, I'm making Redfish Park buttons and pins you can wear. And if you want to express your support for the name, you can give public comment at that meeting. It would be greatly appreciated. More information at whalescout.org, and you can always email me, director@whalescout.org, for more information. And if you have any questions that you want to send just in general or to Jeanette Dorner or any future guests, please email me, director@whalescout.org. And we look forward to seeing you again very soon. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. J'esquive conseil.